Hello and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at the 1939 Western Destry Rides Again, directed by George Marshall. Returning on the show today to talk about Destry Rides Again is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So this was about the second time I've seen this movie. I've seen it about 3 or 4 years ago, and the main reason I saw it is that I know Mel Brooks said that this was a huge influence on Blazing Saddles. And boy, can you tell that this was a huge influence on Blazing Saddles. I think the big thing that comes over in this movie in connection to Blazing Saddles, just how over the top everything is. And that's not necessarily a bad thing because this is a comedy after all. But just everything in the bar is just crazy. There's a cat fight with Marlene Dietrich and this other woman. There's all these large dance numbers. There's all these huge brawls at the end. There's this huge showdown with shootouts, and then like all the women come and like break into the bar and start throwing bricks and taking out the bad guys. I mean, it's just so crazy.
It's a free for all.
Yeah,
yeah. It's a fun movie. I'm glad that it's the. It takes Blazing Saddles kind of to the next level. I'm glad it's the one that, sort of made it happen, because you can sort of see all the humor that's in it. They kind of just take it to the next level in Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, you can just pick up everything. Like Marlene Dietrich, you can tell obviously that, the character of Lily von Stupp from Blazing Saddles is her, not only with the really thick German accent and, which is permeating in her musical performances. But even in her dress and her get-ups, she looks a lot like Marlene Dietrich. And, you have that. And just even like that said, the whole over-the-topness was like at the end of Blazing Saddles when, the brawl is so big, it's breaking the fourth wall literally, and it's going into the Hollywood studio lot.
Yes. Yeah.
We talk about it being a comedy, but, there's also some serious elements at the film. The whole thing is set in motion because the sheriff, which again, Blazing Saddles, is being replaced, and it's like a mystery because they're trying to find out. We know that the crooked gambler killed him, but James Stewart's got to find that out so he can get him out of town. So you have that, and then at the end, Marlene Dietrich dies, and that's played very seriously. That's not played comedically; it's played very tragically. So it's interesting. While this is a comedy, there's still a lot of dramatic elements in it.
In my American cinema class, we talk about Westerns being always a story about loss. Either the loss of the land or the loss of a way of life or a loss of freedom or whatever. So I think that, you almost have to have at least a few moments of seriousness. I don't know, are there any serious moments in Blazing Saddles?
No, that's a straight-up comedy.
Straight-up comedy. But, at least you need, if it's going to be straight-up comedy, you need places where the audience can actually take a breath. You have to have moments that aren't side-splitting, because otherwise you're going to miss all the jokes, and it's just too exhausting to have 2 hours of solid, no break, all laughter.
Yeah, especially with this film where, like I said, everything's just can get really just crazy and over the top, and just everything's getting destroyed in the West, and there's fights, there's crazy fights and everything. Sometimes you just need a calm moment where you just to catch your breath, to calm down, maybe have a more somber, serious moment like with death of Marlene Dietrich, or we find out that the sheriff's been murdered.
Or you have Jimmy Stewart say about yet another person, "I knew a fellow once."
I knew a fellow once.
So, it's funny. It's not a thigh slapper, but it is funny, and it does keep reminding you of that joke every time he says it.
Yeah, it adds a quirk to the character.
Yeah, it does.
And which is funny because at the end, it's almost like when he's talking to the woman, he's like, "Oh, I knew a fellow once," and then the credits start playing over it. It's like almost like the movie itself is getting tired of him telling that, so they're just like, okay, we'll just skip it this time.
And isn't the movie ever be telling kind of "I know a fellow once who"? Yeah, so that's sort of circular in a way.
So did those shifts in tone work for you?
They did. I thought the movie was brilliant. I was enraptured throughout the whole movie. I thought the humor worked. I thought the serious moments worked. I thought the music worked. All these things that shouldn't work together, I thought worked.
Yeah, and even when you talked about the West, how it's always about loss, to me, you're right. And I think another thing about the West to me is always reforming, taming of the West. You're taming this wild town. And that's what Stewart's doing. He's even sort of like in Blazing Saddles, but, he's sort of, everybody thinks he's just this wimp, and they think he's just going to let us do what we want. We're going to have all these wild parties, and the gamblers are going to run the town and everything. And his whole thing is he's trying to find a way, because he knows he's a bad guy, but he doesn't have any evidence. Like the part when he's kicking out that family's house because he cheated him on a bet, he has no legal right to like stop him from doing that because it's been the legal thing. So he's trying to find a way where he can pin something on him and make it stick and get him out of town.
Yeah, and the interesting thing too, another thing I bring up whenever we talk about Westerns, is when you think about pioneer days, there was no 911 you could call. You know, you were lucky if you had a sheriff. And so people just protected themselves with their guns. You know, you just, it was like really the Wild West. So even though you have law and order, it's only as good as the guy who says he's the law and order. You know, if people don't respect him, then you, there's really, there's no higher body you can call. It's all every man for himself. It, that sort of lawlessness in the law is one of the things I think makes Westerns so interesting. Yeah.
And actually, just you talk about Westerns, a show I just watched recently was on Netflix called Godless. And it's sort of this story of, the, you know, it's a story in this mining town where all the men have died in this accident, so all the women are left alone for themselves. And anyway, one day this outlaw who's treated this, like outlaw who's treated him as like a father figure, hides in the town. And so the other outlaw finds out, and this outlaw's crazy, and he's going to destroy everything. So all the women are have a sheriff, but he's out looking for somebody, so they're left to defend themselves. So, and the end of the episode leads to this giant showdown with guns and a battle, and that's sort. But that's sort of like, it's the West. You have, you know, there's not a marshal or sheriff nearby. It's not like you have 911 or you can get cars there quickly. So you got to do everything yourself back in that.
Yeah, you have to be very. Self-aware and ready to defend yourself. Not for chickens. I mean, it's for people who were, you know, really ready to... I think the reason they have all those brawls and stuff is because it probably was like that. You know, you really had to fight your way out of almost everything.
You had to be tough. I mean, not only...
You had to be tough.
Not only with the outlaws, but even, you never know, you know, as far as, you know, hostile Indian attacks, like something that happened in The Searchers, which was actually based on a real life event. You don't know about that. There's just so... And even... Back in the early days of the Civil War, you know, you had people in the, depending on what your loyalties lied, they could kill, you know, they could destroy your house or kill you for being pro-Union or pro-Confederate.
Or you think about a movie like High Noon, where Gary Cooper is waiting for these, you know, guys who broke out of jail or got out of jail, I can't remember, but they're showing up on the noon train, and he's trying to get people to stand with them, and no one wants to, including his wife, who's a Quaker. And that's a typical Western story, too. The loner comes in from somewhere else, has to fix some horrible problem. The townspeople can't get it together. And then he kind of, you know, goes off
afterwards off
into the sunset. Now, Gary Cooper, of course, was married in the movie. But, you know, you see this in Shane, and you see it in every John Wayne movie. You know, he always blows into town to fix things and then he leaves. And he never seems, he's a rolling stone. You know, nobody ever is able to tie him down, you know, for very long.
And even think of that famous shot at the end of The Searchers once he's rescued
Debbie,
and he's got to the family and, you know, he's just, they're all happy, but he's out on the outside and he doesn't go in. He's just sort of awkwardly standing there and the door shuts and you can see him kind of riding off like his job is done. We don't need you anymore.
Yeah. And of course, John Ford likes to film everybody, you know, within those doorways and things. So and then he always likes to put people in shadow, too. So you see that they're the outline of them is there, but, you know, they're really not there.
And it's funny. Just you talk about that Searcher shot. They're showing on TV a lot of this new Western with Christian Bale called Hostiles. And one of the first images they show in that trailer is this John Ford-like shot. These people open up a door with a gun. It's all set and silhouetted in black, but you can see all the bright sun outside.
See, I think that helps every movie that wants to be a Western because you immediately think, oh, John Ford.
John Ford, yeah. And one of the big stars, I think, in this movie is Marlena Dietrich, just because she's just... going everywhere in this movie. She's fighting, she's singing, she's throwing, when she's getting angry at, you know, James Stewart after he throws water on her for the fight, she's like throwing everything she can at him. I mean, she's going all out in this performance.
I really like her in this performance, and, you know, she's very spunky, and they asked her to do the movie, and she said, well, you know, will this help against the Nazis? And they said yes. So she threw herself into this movie. And that fight scene was not choreographed. They just told the two women to just go at it. They're pulling hair, and stomping on each other's feet. And the other actress said that Marlena Dietrich had on high heels and stomped on her feet. She said the toenails never grew back. She said they were black and blue. Ooh, she said it was a real fight. They were rolling around. And they had to do it several times because they had to do it. You know, Jimmy Stewart throws the water on them. And then, okay, now we have to do it from a long shot. So they had to do it again.
Oh, my God.
Throw the water on them. And then, okay, wait a minute. Now we have to do some publicity stills. They had to do it again, throw the water on. They said it was just exhausting doing that scene. But her career was kind of, it had sort of ebbed a little bit. This put her back up. So I think it was a really good strategic movie. And there's a line that she does, and I've heard this before, so it must be famous even though they cut it from the movie, but she put some money in her cleavage and says, there's gold in them thar hills. And apparently the test audience just cracked up.
Yeah.
They said, yeah, we got to take that out. See, they'd leave it in now.
They didn't leave it in?
They would leave it in now.
Yeah.
And they would definitely leave it in Blazing Saddles, but I guess it was too racy for then. Marlena Dietrich and Jimmy Stewart apparently had an affair through this entire movie as well.
And you're talking about Marlena Dietrich. I know early on she did...
The Blue Angel.
Blue Angel with Sternberg.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and like after
and
that...
And she was involved with him too
yeah.
when she made the movie.
And was she big... Did you have a career in Germany before she came to
yes,
America?
Yes, she was a very big deal. And she was very well known as a singer too. So mm-hmm. she... I think when people think of Marlena Dietrich, they think of her as the Blue Angel, like that German actress who did a couple of movies.
She's got like... I remember she's got like the top hat and she's smoking a cigarette. Yeah.
She was in a Hitchcock movie, though, called Stage Fright, in which she was terrific as well.
That's a good one.
It's a little known one.
Yeah, they were playing it, but I didn't really get a chance to see it. But yeah, and Marlena Dietrich, I'll have to ask, do you like her singing just because, I don't know, maybe it's because... maybe once again, I'm always this Madeline Kahn is always going to be in the back of my head, but it's always just seems like really thick, like a thick German accent. And it's just always kind of very monotone, with this deep voice. And I don't know. I'm not sure if it's a. Do you like her singing?
I don't like this kind of singing. I think she's a good singer, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's something very cross-dressing almost about it.
It seems like
Victoria.
Maybe if she just sang it in German, I think it would probably sound a lot better. But I think German with, you know, speaking American with a very thick German accent, you know, almost like, I am not a wabbit, like in Blazing Saddles. It's just, I don't know, maybe it just doesn't quite work for me.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it worked then, because I don't know how much anti-German sentiment there was. Mm-hmm. Today it sounds very obvious, her accent sounds very pronounced, mm-hmm. much more so than the other characters.
You see, you're talking a little bit about where she said, like, well, this helped fight the Nazis because this was 1939, so World War II was just starting. We weren't in it yet. But so was that, do you feel, I didn't see anything, but is there any kind of World War II commentary in this film? Because I don't think I didn't quite get any of that.
No, I don't think so. No, I think the idea, though, is if she did anything promoting an American thing, would it be another chink in their armor, I guess. Yeah, I don't think it was meant. Yeah, let's make that movie where we make that statement about the Nazis. It was, my career's kind of flagging, but if I make this movie and I rally, will that help the cause?
Yeah, or here's this German immigrant that's a true American.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm imagining at this time the Nazis denounced her.
I think they either denounced her or ignored her, hoping that her, you know, they didn't want to give her any extra press. Mm-hmm.
And, think Marlena Dietrich is, you know, she had an extremely long career because not only with this movie, so I'm thinking later on, I think a very underrated film was A Witness for the Prosecution.
Yes.
And that, and she was also in Touch of Evil a little bit, in Judgment Nuremberg. So she's had this great long career.
Yeah, I think of her as Garbo, but more approachable because mm-hmm. she did more movies and more interviews and was more... willing to be a movie star.
Yeah, and even Garbo, didn't Garbo kind of retire young?
Yes, I want to be alone.
And so we talk a bit about Marlena Dietrich. This was also a big thing for James Stewart because mm-hmm. he was still not quite James Stewart yet. This was 39, so at this point, and he was still early on. He did You Can't Take It With You, and I think this is the same year Mr. Smith Goes to Washington came out. And he also did a Thin Man sequel, which was sort of his first notable role. I think it was his very first role. So he had a couple of things under his belt, but this is still before the big James Stewart.
Well, you know, it's hard to think about James Stewart without thinking about It's a Wonderful Life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so intrinsic to the way I think of him because it was the first movie I saw with him in it. So, and I just love that character. Of course, that's the Jimmy Stewart character. Ah. So every time he brings that character to a movie, I like the movie. I don't really want to see him do anything else but Jim Stewart. You know, he's James Stewart when he's in Rear Window, and he's the same in Vertigo. He's always that nice guy, even if he's playing somebody who's not nice. There's something very folksy and down home about him.
And you definitely get it in this movie. It's very similar to his role in Harvey.
Yes.
Both of these, you know, he's kind of happy-go-lucky guy, goes by the seat of his pants or whatever.
A little self-deprecatory, doesn't take himself too seriously.
Everybody thinks he's kind of strange. He tells a lot of stories. He hardly ever raises his voice in anger towards anybody. In this movie, he does because he's got to be the sheriff or whatever. But in Harvey, he definitely doesn't.
I love Harvey, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, that's the perfect vehicle for Jimmy Stewart, you know, because there is something very sympathetic about him always. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting when we talk about, like, the old-time Western heroes. The first thing everybody go to, obviously, is John Wayne. And then probably people will say Gary Cooper because of High Noon. And I think sort of James Stewart kind of gets lost because, he's done a lot of movies outside of Westerns. But he's done quite a few Westerns. I mean, this movie, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Oh, my favorite. That was my favorite.
Classic. And, you know, I think...
The Shootist.
He was in The Shootist. I forgot about that. And I think some of the movies he did in Westerns, I think, sort of get forgot. The ones he did with Anthony Mann, they were The Naked Spur, The Man from Laramie. And, like, in those movies, he's got a bit of a dark side to him, which I kind of like. He's still kind of James Stewart. He's still a good guy, but he can get, you know, you push him a little bit, he'll go crazy. Like, even in Naked Spur, like, he goes to some pretty dark places in that movie, almost like where he did in Vertigo.
See, I think you end up liking James Stewart, but not necessarily think of him as a Western hero.
Yeah, good.
You know, because it sort of feels like, you know, you're in the movie. If you were in the movie, you'd end up being James Stewart, you know, trying your best, you know, against all odds. But there is something non-heroic, non-leading man in a way, because he doesn't have the advantage John Wayne did in all of his movies, where he always prevailed. I mean, no matter what happened to John Wayne, he always came out on top. So that made him seem like the strong, silent type.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because you think John Wayne was a big guy.
He was a really tall guy.
He was a tall guy. So you see that he's this, you know, almost like superhero, like a Superman of the West. And James Stewart, he's a skinny guy.
He's the 98-pound weakling guy with the sand kicked in his face.
So it's almost like he's an everyday guy.
He's an everyday guy. If they remade all those movies, they'd make him with Tom Hanks in the Jim Stewart world. Because even though Tom Hanks has done some serious drama, you still think of him as the guy next door.
Everyday good guy. Yeah,
everyday good guy. And Gary Cooper was, you know, this extremely handsome matinee idol. So when he did, you know, The Sheriff or whatever, he was just sort of being, again, the strong, silent type. Very attractive, very movie, matinee idol kind of thing, which, again, is not James Stewart.
James Stewart is more of the every guy. Like, you can see, like, I would probably do the exact same thing in his situation.
Yeah, and he's sort of a little shuffling and a little, you know, stammering. And there's something very lovable about James Stewart.
Which actually sort of leads into my next question is, he sort of reminds me a lot like a Columbo.
Yes.
Where Columbo is, you know, from...
Okay, the Ratty Raincoat.
Yeah, I probably have to talk this to anybody who's young, because most people don't know who Columbo is, who's like under the age of like 30. But he was this popular TV show and this cop, and he would always trick people because he would always be very nice and he always stuttered a little thing. Nobody would think he knew anything what they did about a murder. But then somehow go, oh, by the way, or something, and then boom, he's got you and he's tricked you. He's lulled you into a false sense of security. That's what Stewart is. In the beginning, he's this pansy. He's a weakling. He can't do anything. But then they slowly figure out that he's building up a case on them. And then, boom, he gets them at the end.
And he's a good shot, too. Mm-hmm. You know, also don't expect him to be a marksman.
Mm-hmm. Because we were talking a little bit earlier about Three Billboards, he reminds me a little bit of like a Margie from Fargo.
Yes.
Because Margie is just so darn nice and polite to everybody. She's got that Minnesota accent. But also she's a darn good cop. And because she's so nice, nobody really thinks that she's onto them, but then she's onto them and she uncovers the case.
You know, another role that's like that is Kevin Spacey in The Usual Suspects.
Oh,
because
yeah, yeah.
they have him, you know, you think, oh, he's, This poor guy is what you're thinking in the beginning of the movie. Yeah.
And you think, oh, he couldn't possibly do
it. Yeah, he couldn't have had anything to do with it. They're just picking on him.
So other performances that stand out for you, I want to give one shout out to the bartender in the movie, who was Billy Gilbert. And you don't know the name, but once you see that guy's face, you'll recognize a million things he's done. Like for two things that already stick out to my mind, he was in His Girl Friday. He was one of the guys they try to buy off, the politicians try to buy off during one point, but he doesn't buy, you know, he kind of screws things up because he just keeps talking. And then he was also in The Great Dictator with Charlie Chaplin. I think he was supposed to be making, he was called Herring, which was supposed to be making fun of Joseph Goering. But he always is kind of that character actor. I think he's done stuff with the Three Stooges, and he's always kind of that big, goofy, comedic guy. And he never, you don't know his name, but you'll recognize that face because he's in a lot of these movies.
Yeah, you see, I know that guy. I know I've seen that guy before. I did want to ask you what you thought of the name of Sheriff Dimmesdale. Do you think that was meant to be any sort of reference to Nathaniel Hawthorne and the Scarlet Letter, the Reverend Dimmesdale, who was corrupt and was really the problem behind everything, and you know, should have been the one to be the straight up guy, but of course is too busy hiding his own sins to be the straight up guy. I didn't know if you thought that was a coincidence or
maybe. I mean, this is definitely more comedic and not as serious, but yeah, that's actually a good point. I could see that happening.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're going to put a character in a doorway and evoke John Ford, I think everything like that is sort of like, oh, wait a minute, is that deliberate? Mm-hmm. Because you can choose any name, so. I mean, that's what I think of when I think of Dimmesdale. Maybe it's a common name back then.
Maybe.
It just jumped out at me.
Yeah, sure. You know, we're talking about it. This is loosely based on a story by Max Brand. I was looking at it. It's interesting. This isn't the first time this story's been done. It was remade into a number of movies. It was also done in a play, and there was even a TV show done about this same story.
I am really not familiar with Max Brand. Me neither. I have been looking up some Westerns to read, and I just downloaded Riders of the Purple Sage to read.
Yeah, I know that's a classic. The Searchers, the book, that's the one I would recommend. And another, actually, which you just talked about recently, I have you can find the audio book for The Assassination of Jesse James.
Okay.
And that's one of my favorite. Oh, and then you all can also find the book for Shane. That's another one I would recommend as far as Western books.
I think we do have that one up in my office because we have the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, something about George Marshall, the director, you know, he started work as an extra.
In what movie?
I don't know, but he got to start as Universal and started work as an extra. You know, this big 6-foot guy earned a dollar every time he fell off a horse.
Kind of like.
So he did these two real Westerns and adventure serials starring the popular Ruth Roland. So, you know, he eventually got into doing Westerns after really starting from the absolute bottom.
Yeah, and I was looking at his career. On his IMDb, he has 185 credits. That's a combination of movies and like TV episodes he's directed.
And short stuff.
So he's this is probably his most notable film. Looking at nothing else really sticks out. Two other films of his I've seen. One was The Blue Dahlia. That's was with Alan Ladd.
Yes, okay.
And Veronica Lake. Couple other people. It's written by a screenplay by Raymond Chandler. It's supposed to be this huge film noir, and it's good, but I think it was sort of, it could have been a heck of a lot better. That's his other one. And another one, I kind of ran into this one time early morning when I had T. Turner Classic on. It was called Valley of the Sun. Nothing really notable about it, except it's an early film for Lucille Ball.
Okay.
She's really good. The film is, I couldn't tell you anything else about it, but she's really good in it. So those are only any other stuff of his you've seen? Because those are only other two of his I've seen.
No, I have never seen him in other things. I just thought it was interesting that he started off really in the beginning doing falling off horses for a dollar per.
He's kind of one of those guys that, you know, never have made their mark as far as like huge, huge impactful films like a Ford or a Houston or whatever. But he's done a lot of hard, he's the hardworking studio guy, just pumps out a lot of stuff. If you need a job, he'll get it done for you.
Yep, I think that's a great way to sum him up. Did you know they wanted to call this the Man from Montana?
No, I did not.
I don't think I like that title as much as Destry Rides Again. It sounds more exciting.
Yeah, Man from Montana makes it all mysterious and everything, like Man from Laramie. That wouldn't really fit this movie very well.
Well, Laramie at least makes me think it's the Old West, because that used to be the capital before. Now it's Cheyenne. So as soon as you say Laramie, I'm immediately thinking it's in the past.
Yes. Okay.
Where Man from Montana could be, you know, the guy who beat up the reporter and got elected anyway. There was a big story in Montana recently.
Oh, okay. I was wondering what you're talking about.
I mean, that could
about.
Be the Man from Montana. I mean, it could be anything.
Okay. So we could talk a little bit about other comedy westerns. We've talked about Blazing Saddles, so I won't bring that up again. But there are a couple Italian westerns called the Trinity movies. One is called My Name is Trinity, and another one's called, like, Trinity is Still My Name. They're pretty good. Farley Granger's actually in one of them. I recommend those. There's another Italian comedy western. It was called My Name is Nobody, which was in part written by Sergio Leone. And Henry Fonda's in it. That's another one I'd recommend. One I wouldn't recommend at all because it's just awful is the Seth MacFarlane's Million Ways to Die in the West. He did it a couple years ago. It seems like it's a comedy western directed by a guy who may have seen like one western in his life, and it was probably Back to the Future 3.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah, just don't watch it. I don't recommend it.
I'm trying to think of comedies and westerns.
Maybe Back to the Future 3, that counts.
Yeah, maybe Back to the Future 3. I don't know. You can count more things if you include all the space westerns, you know, like Star Wars.
Star Wars, and then that show Firefly. I haven't seen it, but that's supposed to be like a comedy.
Yeah.
Okay, so then last question I'll just ask for you. Is there anything else you want to bring up or talk about as far as this movie, James Stewart, or westerns in particular?
Well, what do you think about James Stewart as a western idol? You know, why do you think he hasn't gotten more, you know, accolades?
I think it's mainly because he's done a lot of work, notable work, outside of the westerns. Think of the Hitchcock movies. Think of, you know, his stuff with Frank Capra. You know, and even something like Anatomy of a Murder. A lot of his stuff, western stuff, is iconic, but he's left his mark in a lot of other things. Like, and take somebody like John Wayne. Sure, he's done a lot of war movies. He did The Quiet Man. He's mainly stayed in that Western genre. So when everybody thinks of John Wayne, they're going to think of Western hero. When they think of James Stewart, they might think of like Rear Window or Vertigo, or they might think of It's a Wonderful Life.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Harvey.
Or Harvey, yeah. That's a lot. But they might not think of, you know, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance at least first.
Yeah, I think it's important, though, if you are a Jimmy Stewart fan, to go back and see some of these westerns, even if you don't like westerns. See The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and see Destry Rides Again.
Yep, definitely. Okay, then the last question I'll have is, you talked about already, but tell us about your classes.
Well, in the spring, I'm teaching Intro to Film, American Cinema, and World Cinema. And we do talk about the western in American cinema.
Okay.
And we watch The Searchers.
Ooh, okay. All right, well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about director George Marshall and his 1939 western, Destry Rides Again. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me back.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying all I want is to be a cowboy and to wear my own pants.